Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we have a fantastic guest with us. We've been talking about pastry for the past 40 minutes. And we have a great chocolate maker locally, Albert Kirschmeier. How are you, Albert?
Oh, fine. I'm glad to be here.
And so your job is to make everyone really upset and hungry and desperate for chocolate today. Do you think you can get that done?
I'm going to try and I'm going to work on it. So,
how long have you been making people upset and angry and needing chocolate?
Actually, we are starting our 27th year, is unbelievable. That makes me like 32.
So. You know, Europeans start so young. Yeah.
apprenticed at three.
Right. You really were young.
So when tell us a little bit about your story and how you got to pastry and to chocolate. And actually,
my training is in cooking, and I decided to explore into another area. And so I went back to Germany and Switzerland and actually apprenticed to learn how to make chocolate. And I went to a school in Lucerne that gave me the theoretical knowledge. And I came back like a year later and had a shop in a container and started the business like 6 months after that. So it was a little risky, but it worked out. I guess a certain percentage has to succeed, and I was lucky enough to be one of them.
So if your work life is pastry, is chocolate, what happened, what was the thing that happened when you were a kid that made you realize that maybe that was it, or food? I mean, obviously, you went to school for cooking. You had desires about it, right?
Yeah. Actually, you know, chocolate was more of a mystery to me, so I was in a trade show, and this guy was doing a demo on chocolate that, you know, at that time the importers brought chocolate into the country to create a demand for it. And when I saw how he made chocolates, and I thought, wow, this is interesting. So I actually thought about it for a little bit, and I called my old boss in Germany, my old instructor in a cooking school, and I said, you know, are there any shops that would take an apprentice learning the trade, because I really, you know, this is not an industry that was very known in this country. And I thought, you know, this would be really something that I could start here, you know. But I didn't really do much research. Otherwise, I would not be in business. Obviously, I just did it from the heart. And that's what made everything, you know, it worked out. Let's put it that way, you know.
It's the same honest way we ended up in the restaurant business.
So definitely.
If I would have had a business plan and somebody would have looked it over and said, you know, you have to sell so many and how many can you make, it would have looked pretty bad on paper. But I was very lucky in Baltimore. I got an enormous amount of support from the press, the media was, they just loved me, you know. I mean, we had constantly people were coming in and wanted to see how Easter Bunny is made or how, you know, something for Mother's Day. And they were incredibly supportive. And I think
That's
basically
great.
they put us on the map. So
what is the cycle of the chocolate maker's year?
I mean, we have the certainly starting Thanksgiving is one of the starting points. Halloween, we make a little bit of, you know, scary faces for the kids or, you know, people.
You do, or you make chocolate look that,
yeah,
that way?
I sometimes look scary, but and then Thanksgiving is the first kickoff, and after that, it's just rolling into Christmas. What is basically, we do probably 30% of our business in a period of 2 weeks. Around Christmas, you know, big corporations, they order, you know, large amounts of chocolates, and then you work around the clock. But then the trade-off is that after Easter, everything dies down, and we really enjoy life and have, you know, nice summertime to enjoy your garden and do other things.
Is there something that does best in the summertime, chocolate-covered strawberries or something?
Yeah, we do that. 2 years ago, I decided to maybe bring something new into the business, and that was making ice cream. So again, I went to Germany to a school to learn how to make ice cream. and never realized how scientific it is and how it's even more scientific than chocolate making, because if your percentages of ingredients are not right and one ice cream is hard like a rock and the other one is soft like butter, so in order for you to weigh all that out, you have to know, you know, how much sugar contents does your strawberry have that you use, and then know that your percentages are in order. But that's something that we started, and it's really it's coming along nicely. I mean, you know, it takes a while before you get people to, when they think of ice cream, they think of you. But we're plucking along.
Do I remember correctly that you've traveled to Central or South America to learn about chocolate?
I was fortunate enough last year to, and I'm working on it, that I may be invited again to go to Peru. And we were basically ambassadors from different countries to come and visit cocoa plantations. And it was really interesting to see, you know, how the cocoa is grown and get the feedback from the different farmers and you know what their projections are and how they you know what they do. And finally I completed the circle. You know, I know how to work with chocolate and now I know what creates the characters. You know, it's very similar to coffee or wine, by that matter. You know, the Riesling grape has a different taste in grown in the Alsace than it will have in on the Rhine River. You know, although the Rhine is also in the Alsace, but it's you know, different grapes will pick up different characters, and it's the same thing.
Different places with the chocolate. Reflect different growing seasons.
Exactly, and the soil contents, you know, will create the correct character of the bean. And so we have, I mean, if you want me to get into a little bit of the history of the chocolate, but the cocoa beans are basically grown in around the equator, 20 degrees up and down. So the main growing areas is where the bulk of the chocolate comes from, is the Ivory Coast, Ghana, African country. But the more boutique chocolates come from the Ecuador, Venezuela, Trinidad, Peru. And what was really interesting, Peru has exceptional beans.
Is it because of the altitude?
Yeah, they have, the soil is just superb for them. Cocoa is actually an undergrowth, so you need, they don't like a lot of wind, they don't like a lot of sun. So, Peru, the Andes, they have, you know, the ideal growing areas, just like they have for the coffee. And so I have found some or tasted some of the beans that have just an enormous, it gives you the feel like you're eating a rich Bordeaux. You know, they have like depth to them and they have characters. You can really, you know, taste the individual, like the description, you know, like in a heavy wine, you know.
Go ahead.
How can a consumer taste? I mean, what are favorite chocolates of yours, you know, and types, and how can a consumer taste those things?
You know, in today's time, what people are looking for now is the single origin chocolates. You know, they go out there and they say, "Oh, I want the Venezuelan or the bean from Trinidad." What is actually not. It's a myth, because it's like your wines are going to be different every year, you know, and your cocoa is the growing conditions are different, so they will taste different. So it's not like you're going to get the same product consistently. But there is somehow, you know, how can I say, not a mystique, but it was marketed as such, you know.
Bordeaux will always taste more like Bordeaux than it does like Burgundy, regardless of the vintage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. You're right.
So the question is:
so there are certain characteristics for every chocolate, no matter the growth season.
The African beans have much less, you know, character, then that's why the mass market is using the African beans. But the American countries, you know, South America especially, has more depth to the chocolate. So you will find much richer characters, and that's why a lot of boutique chocolatiers, you know, really like to use them.
How many different types of chocolate do you use?
I get my chocolate from Germany, and they import. It's a small company, has like 200 employees, has been around for about 110 years, and they get beans from all over the world. And I can specifically, you know, get Peruvian organic chocolate, for example. And I always like to mix, you know, get the character from a Peruvian bean, but get the darkness from a Venezuelan bean. So I just make my own little blend.
Sure.
Some is better for coating. Other ones is better for making fillings and stuff like that. So basically, I mix and match.
Can you explain what the percentage means so people understand what they're buying when they...
Yeah. So the cocoa percentage that everybody is looking for is actually the amount of cocoa, but it also includes the cocoa butter. So it's actually a myth. If you say, you know, there's 70% cocoa, that 70% is also part of it is the cocoa butter. And but it's an unsaturated fat, so it's actually good for you. It's like eating olive oil.
Every listener wants to hear that all the chocolate they eat is making them as healthy as the olive oil might be.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's a happy day today. You've really made people's days.
Yep. You have a need to be popular, don't you? You want to be in the chocolate business and the ice cream business.
Exactly. But it's really interesting. People ask for the 70% cocoa, but there is. I talked to a professor in Penn State a couple of years ago, and she said that chocolate has actually, they have isolated over 400 properties. It's a very complex food, and they are still finding different chemicals inside of the chocolate, and they haven't found a bad one yet, mm-hmm. I think.
Well, there's so many polyphenols. Again, like the wine parallel, it's a remarkable number of sort of flavor vectors and characteristics all in some kind of dynamic balance depending upon how you manipulate it.
Exactly. That's... but then on the other hand is working with chocolate is another thing. It's rather complicated. People will know that when they ever try to get good chocolate and they melt it down and they try to put it in a mold and it doesn't release. So the what we call tempering of the chocolate is basically you condition the chocolate to be able to create a bond between the fat crystals. And if you don't understand the science behind it, it's really tough to work with it. You really have to read up and understand what you're trying to accomplish. And that's why people sometimes call me and say, you know, I work with this chocolate, but I don't know. I think something is wrong with it. You know,
it's the person, not the chocolate.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's not just put it in a bowl and melt it. It's so tempering. Can you talk at all about that without?
Tempering is basically a conditioning. I always try to explain it as such. If you take a pot of water and you bring it up to, you know, 0 degrees or 32 degrees till it becomes to the state where it turns from water to ice. And basically in chocolate, you have two crystallization. You have a sugar crystals and you have the fat crystals. The fat crystals are like that ice crystal that is floating around in there. So as soon as the temperature comes to a certain stage, you start to turn the fat or the cocoa butter will turn from an oil to a fat. And in that moment, when it turns to the fat, it creates a crystal just like a snowflake. But it has to have that other crystal to attach itself. So what you don't want to have, you don't want to have a bucket full of snow. You want to have a bucket full of ice. And that's exactly the same principle. Your crystal is has to be conditioned. So the next crystal that is coming along and turning to a hard stage will attach itself to the next crystal. And that is what you want. You want to have a certain amount of crystals inside of your fat, if your chocolate, that the other ones that are coming along attaching themselves. And it takes a small percentage of them being ready for the other ones to come along and grabbing it. But if you don't do that, this is what happens when you leave your chocolate in the car and you bring it home and you take it out and you say, oh my God, it's all melted, and you let it sit, and you will see it turns gray. And what that is those fat crystals that were in a solid stage, they basically made their way to the top, just like any oil does. It's lighter than the other ingredients, so it rises to the top, and now the room temperature will make it into a fat crystal again. And all of a sudden, there's this snowflake on top of your chocolate. That is an individual fat crystal that hasn't attached itself to another one. So if you would look under the microscope, or even if you take a really close look at the chocolate that turned gray, you will see those little crystals on top floating around. So if you would take that and you melt it all back down again and condition it, what we call temper, you can create another emulsion, and you will have a solid.
So you can fix it.
You can fix it.
That's pretty
just
good.
Like you can
That's
fix a hollandaise, you know, when it's broken. Same
thing.
What
about when you're making, let's say, a chocolate cake, and you're actually melting, mixing butter into that chocolate? What about that process?
Yeah, basically, what you do is you change the fat. You basically make it more pliable. You can actually cut the chocolate because the butterfat inside of the other oils,
it's a little easier to manage.
Exactly. So you can actually cut the chocolate because the cocoa butter itself is a very hard oil at room temperature.
A less technical question, but having to do with things like chocolate cake, and I know I want to know, what do you order for dessert when you go to restaurants? What are your favorite desserts in restaurants?
Actually, I am not a chocolate eater.
But if you smell it all day, right?
I don't. Yeah. I eat chocolate at work.
It's like when people winemakers end up drinking beer while they're making wine during that season. They can't stand it.
Yeah, that's exactly because I'm around it so much that I will never order a chocolate dessert unless somebody has one that has a mystique behind it, and I want to figure out how they did that. But I don't eat chocolate. Ice cream either.
That's interesting.
So a favorite dessert, a favorite ice cream? Just as the last question.
Actually, ice cream, I like black currant.
Ooh, yum.
And also black currant is really awesome with chocolate. It's a really great combination. And I want to just get into something. We're just created chocolate bars that are made with different berries from around the world. And one of the berries I got from Poland is black currants or Inca berries from Peru and mulberries from Iran and barberries from the Middle East.
Oh, so, I love barberries.
Yeah.
I love barberries.
There's a farm on the Eastern Shore, by the way, who right now has milberries in season if you want some.
Wow, that's a
super, super duper rare thing. But there's a, I'll tell you off the air if you like.
Yeah, yeah. Great.
Anyway, thanks for coming on the program.
Yes, thank you so much, Albert.
Yes, it was a pleasure to be here.
Yes.
And where would people find your marvelous chocolates?
We are up in Deer Core Road in Timonium, right off 83, second exit of 83.
Great. Good. Everybody thanks. Should go visit you.
So I'm going to have to go send and get some chocolates.
Okay. I'll just keep talking while you all leave.
Thanks for listening to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf. Have a good day.